You're listening to Truth To You Radio with Jono on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter and keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. G'day, wherever you may be listening around the world, particularly in West Palm Beach, Florida. In fact, a shout out to everybody listening in Florida. It so happens that my next guest is also from Florida. Welcome for the first time on Truth To You, Torah teacher Ira Michelson.
Hey, Jono, how you doing?
G'day, mate. I'm so rapt to have you on the program for the first time on Truth To You.
And I love West Palm Beach. I actually lived down there before we moved up to Central Florida.
Indeed. You know what? I've been looking at the stats lately, and there's a lot of listeners in Florida. There's listeners in Claremont, Fort Lauderdale. In fact, let me have a look. There's quite a few places here.
I actually live in Claremont.
Maybe there you go.
Maybe that's me listening.
It might be you.
It might be me.
Well, g'day to you.
And thanks. How about a shout out to me?
Shout out to Ira and Palm Coast. I've also got Palm Coast here. So there's a lot of listeners in Florida. So g'day to you guys. It's wonderful to have you listening. And my friend, I tell you what, we are going to be tackling one of the, I don't know, what might be considered to be one of the stranger books of the Bible in some ways. There's a lot of curiosity about certain passages in the book we're about to examine and read through. It also happens to be, in the opinion of many scholars, the oldest book in the Bible. Now, when I say that, a lot of people, and in fact, I remember when somebody said that, the first thing that came to my mind was, oh, we're going to be talking about Genesis. We're going to be talking about Bereshit. That's not the case. What are we going to be talking about, Ira?
We are going to be talking about the book of Iov, the book of Job. And not only is it known to be considered one of the oldest books in Scripture, but it's considered to be one of the strangest books to read. But not only strange, and strange because it's said to have some very obscure Hebrew, but that's not unusual for poetic works. We see that through the prophets as well, that sometimes there's a lot of poetry, sometimes we see Aramaic, and it's said that a book like Iov can't be understood unless you know some of that, unless you know some Aramaic, unless you're able to understand some of the obscure Hebrew that the poets would use. But it's also said to be one of the greatest works of literature and one of the greatest works of poetry that's ever written as well.
And it has an enormous amount of poetry in it. You say that it has a little bit of Aramaic. I wasn't aware of that. So,
well, not necessarily Aramaic, but I think what ends up happening is if you understand Hebrew, not necessarily that they're the same language, but what ends up happening is if there's something obscure, if there's this kind of obscure language, then what we have to do is we have to fall back on context. And and we see that throughout. There's actually, we'll get to it much later in the book, but there's in Job chapter 38, there's a word that actually means rooster in Hebrew, but it's obviously not talking about a rooster. It's talking about a specific part of the body that's referred to. So
right.
Where you see something like that, you have to fall back on what the context is and try and figure out what you're actually looking at. And sometimes we're not going to be able to, and we just say kacha in Hebrew
kacha.
Because.
It's just kacha. Because. Well, let's talk about the context for a minute, because the book of Job, I mean, the way that it begins, it says there was a man in the land of Uz. Where is the land of Uz?
That's a very interesting concept. There's a lot of different commentary on this as it relates to where the land of Uz was, because we see in one of the verses early on that it talks about he was a great man from the east. There are those that think that it was actually very close to the land of Israel, and potentially could be around the area of what's now known as around Syria, but we're not really sure. And there's all different types of interpretations about this. I think what's really important is that not only that it says that he's a man from Uz, but it actually says Ish Haya Be'eretz Uz. And it's interesting because Ish Haya, normally we would see it the other way around. It would say Haya Ish. There, you know, there was this man, and here it says Ish Haya. So even in that, we see a little bit of a different kind of Hebrew there. And it's shown to stand out. This is a special kind of man that we're talking about here.
I have heard it said that Job, or in Hebrew, I heard you say Iov. Is that
Iov,
correct?
Yes,
Iov. Eov is a contemporary of Abraham. Is that fair?
There's one of the things that says he's a contemporary of Abraham or a contemporary of the patriarchs, and I think some of that comes from dating back when we look at some of the rabbinic dating of different events. The other thing that I find really interesting is that one of the things that that I've seen put forth is the idea that he was actually a king, that specifically he might have been King Jobab, that we see in scriptures. And the reason for that is that there's a verse in, I believe it's in Job chapter 9, verse 19, where he talks about his glory being stripped or his crown being removed from him in one of the dissertations that that Job makes. So we see that as well. It's very interesting.
Because in the second and third verse, in fact, I may as well, I'll tell you what, we'll get to that in just a minute, but when I read that, I wondered, is he some sort of a king, or at least his populace is concerned. So he is potentially a contemporary of Abraham or the patriarchs. Do we understand that this book was written in that period, and thus some scholars say it's the oldest book in the Bible, or do we understand that it is written about that period? How is it considered as the oldest?
Well, it's considered the oldest because, for the most part, the consensus is from the sages in Judaism that the book was written by Moshe. And some of them to the point that you get into the question of whether or not this was a real person, mm-hmm. or whether or not it was some of them say that Job was a mashal, where we get the word mishle or proverb, that he was a role model,
right,
to teach us about suffering. And so they say that Moshe actually, one of the arguments is that Moshe wrote this about the Egyptian oppression, that he was teaching the Hebrew nation when they were enslaved and suffering under Egyptian oppression, trying to give them a consolation, so to speak. And so this is why it's seen as being very old, also because of the Hebrew, as he said, because it's very obscure Hebrew. And we know a friend of ours didn't want to tackle this because of the obscure Hebrew. His name will go unmentioned.
That's right. I remember a friend saying that he remembers when he was in yeshiva that there was just the general idea that if you bring an example, don't bring it from the book of Job.
Well, because one of the things they say is that the Hebrew is pretty much a dead language. And of course, we know going forward from studies in the more modern times, we know that the Jewish people basically had started speaking Greek and Aramaic, and Hebrew was considered more of a dead language. So that mm-hmm. when you're not just looking at Hebrew, but you're looking at obscure Hebrew as well, it speaks to the dating of the book as well.
Sure. And so there are also, I've heard that possibly Job, if he was a real character, that perhaps he wrote it, or perhaps Elihu, who we'll hear about a little bit later, may have written it. Maybe it was Solomon, because as you say, it does read like a grand proverb. It can be taken that way.
But that is another. Yeah, Solomon is another one that's brought forth.
That's another possibility. And indeed, if Moses wrote it, then I guess in that sense we may be looking at it as an allegory as well. So there's a lot of options there, and there's a lot that is unknown about the book of Job, but it is a fascinating book and one that emphasizes various lessons like no other book in the Bible.
Right.
So we're going to jump into it. Shall I begin?
Sure.
This is the way it starts. It says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil." First question, how does that read in the Hebrew?
Okay, so the Hebrew reads, Ish haya be'eretz Uz, Eov shemo. There was a man in the land of Uz, and his name was Eov. Haya ha'ish ha'hu tam v'yashar v'yirei Elohim v'sar meira. So what it's saying is that he was ha'ish ha'hu tam. We see this a couple of times. Actually, Yaakov was called this as well, an Ish Tam, a blameless man, mm-hmm. Viyashar, Sometimes you hear people talk about Sefer Yashar. You know, people are always looking for the latest thing, but Yashar actually means to be upright. And so it talks about him being blameless and upright, that he fears Elohim and turns aside from evil. Vasar Meira turns from evil.
Turns from evil. So it's pretty comprehensive as far as his description is concerned. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. He has 10 children.
Yep.
And also his possessions, and here we are, his possessions, which are primarily measured in livestock, as we see also with Abraham, is described in a similar way. His possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household, so that this man was greatest of all the people in the East. And now when you read greatest of all the people in the East, I think back to what you said before, that that he may have been considered some kind of a king.
Yes.
It's fair enough, I think.
Yeah. We're dealing with so many different opinions about this. That there's really no way of putting our finger on it. I think there's enough information later in there to make the argument that at the very least, we know that based on what we just read, that he was a very wealthy man and potentially a king as well.
Now, speaking of not being able to put your finger on the specifics, the next verse, verse 4, is one that I've heard a lot of speculation about. It says, and his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his, now I have, Ira, I've got in italics, appointed, and whenever it's in italics, I think, well, that's not there in the Hebrew, and I'd like to hear from you what it says in Hebrew. It says, his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. Appointed day. What have you got?
Well, it doesn't say that in the Hebrew, of course.
Mm-hmm.
In the Hebrew, it says in verse 4, V'halchu banav v'asu mishte beit ish yomo v'shalchu v'karu l'shloshet achiyotehem le'echol v'lishtot imahem. So what it's saying is, V'halchu banav v'asu mishte. The word there, mishteh, is a feast, okay? But it's not like moed. It's not like we read the moedim. So when you see this kind of idea of appointment, I think that it confuses people sometimes, and they confuse this with some of the feasts of Yehovah, which it's not talking about here. So what it's saying is, v'halchu banav v'asu mishteh, that they went, the sons, his sons, to make a feast. Beit ish yomo v'shalchu v'karu, and they go, each one has his own day. And then, of course, we read that they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And so it's interesting when you look at Mishteh. I found an interesting verse, actually. I know that you and Yoel are going through the prophets, and I know that you're dealing with the book of Judges now as well, and this actually comes from the book of Judges. It's Judges chapter 14, verse 10, because I did a word study to look at Mishteh to see if I saw anything that was very interesting about this, and this actually relates to Shimshon, to Samson. And it says, Vayered Avihu el Ha'isha, Vayas Sham Shimshon Mishteh Ki Ken Yasu Habchorim. And what it's saying there is that this is when Samson goes and spies the Philistine woman that he thinks looks pretty good to him, and you know, talks to his parents about. And what it says there is that his father went down to the woman, and then it says, and Shimshon made a feast for the young men customarily do this, or done the way the young men would do at that time. And I thought that was very interesting, because here we see this verse about Job's sons having this, each one having a feast in his house on a particular day and having their sisters come and eating and drinking with them.
Mm-hmm.
And that the mishteh, this feast that they're having, is similar to what other young men would have. So it's not speaking about one of the feasts of Yehovah, but their own feast that they were making.
Their own feast that they were making, a celebration of their own declaration, if you like. But I've also heard it said, Ira, and perhaps you have as well, that it may be in reference to the day of their birth, the birthday.
It's possible. It's very possible because it's talking about a particular day. And, of course, you get into the concept of the pagan aspect of that when it relates to celebrating a birthday.
Sure, sure. And but that's another one of the speculations that I've heard. And that goes in all funny directions. And as far as people saying that, of course, birthdays are evil and you can't have birthdays and you can't celebrate birthdays because they're evil.
Well, that's why I said it. but it's important that we recognize why this concept of the feast is so important, because I think it really speaks to us as we go through the next couple of verses to see why, Job took some of the actions that he took.
Now, this is interesting because that's right, because it says, so it was when the days of feasting had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them. Now, I'll just keep reading. I'll come back to that. He would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. And Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did regularly. Now, if Job did regularly, it would suggest, at least to me, that his sons would feast regularly. And what does it mean, first of all, that Job would send and sanctify them? Does that he would send for them and then set them apart? I mean, is that fair?
Well, I want to see what the Hebrew says here. It says, "Vayehi ki hikfu yemei hamishteh v'yishlach Iyov v'yikad Shem v'hishkim baboker." So it's possible. I don't know that we can say that he was sending for them, but it would make sense that when the days of feasting had completed, he would send and consecrate them, possibly having them participate in the sacrifices as well.
Because it makes you wonder, how does he set them apart? What is there some sort of ritual that we're not reading about here? Is there some sort of, maybe, is there a mikveh or is there some sort of participation in the sacrifice? We don't really know, but it says that he would send and sanctify them. He would rise early in the morning and offer burnt. Now, we read this and we think, is Job... I mean, we speculated a few verses previous that he may have been some sort of a king. Here, we now ask the question, is he also some sort of a priest? Is that fair?
Well, it potentially can happen, and we know that there are certain things that we see that kings would perform that would be a priestly function. We see that with David HaMelech, with King David. We see kings performing priestly functions, so it would not be unlike this. Unlike a king, if he was to also perform some priestly function, we would see this even with pagan kings, and so we don't know because remember, there's nothing that ties Job to anything related to the covenants of God. We just don't have that information here. What I think is really interesting in this verse, though, in his doing this, is what was his motivation for this? And it kind of says that, well, he had a motivation of, making sure that his sons had not sinned and cursed God in their hearts. And he did this continually. But I thought that there was something really interesting, because the question always comes up, because we're going to see this later on when we get into that, not only do we get into the friends of Eov, of Job, but then we get into that that veiled character that appears in a text, who questions the motivation. And I think there's really something that we have to look at here. We really have to question the motivation. And I kind of looked ahead and I thought, I found something very interesting, because when we get past the, and I don't want to jump too far ahead, but there's an interesting verse in Job chapter 3, verse 25, where Job actually says, "For what I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me."
Yes.
So after he's heard everything, and after this kind of discussion that goes on between Yehovah and this other character, and he begins his lament, Job, he says, "For what I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me." So there's a question as to whether or not really he was did have the right motivation or the right agenda for what he was doing. Was he, was he really as blameless and upright as it said of him? Just an interesting.
That's really interesting. That is interesting. I actually, when I read that, I had different thoughts, and we may as well talk about that now. When I read those verses at the end of chapter 3, I thought, I came back to the description of Job, one who is upright, one who is blameless, and who fears God and shuns evil. And to fear God is to have a reverence, but a fearful reverence of God, a high respect and honor of his authority and sovereignty. And to know that, and as we find out a little in the next few verses, the adversary says to God, that you put a hedge around him and around his household and around all that he has on every side.
Who's this adversary?
We're going to get to that in just a minute. You have blessed the work of his hands and his possessions and have been increased. See, he is responsible for it. God is responsible for the blessing, this immeasurable blessing, a huge blessing that's recognized throughout the land, that Job is greatest of all the people in the East, as it says in verse 3. And I wouldn't be surprised, Ira, if you too feel like this. I often feel like that I am far more blessed than I deserve, and that I have more blessing than I know is not of my doing, that I know that God has gracefully and mercifully bestowed upon me. And I also, in the recognition of that, I think to myself how easily it could be taken away, because it's not by my hand that I have these blessings. It's by the hand of my God that I have these blessings. And I think to myself, it could easily turn around by his sovereign will. Well, we find out actually what the determining factors may be throughout this book. And so maybe Job kind of felt like that. Maybe he recognized, in fact, I'm sure he recognized that what he had was because he held to a faithful relationship with his God, that his God had blessed him. And therefore, the thing that he greatly feared has come upon him, and the thing that he dreaded the most has happened to him, and that is that it was all so easily taken away. I don't know. I just that was the way that I interpreted that verse.
Absolutely, there's
a possibility as well. Now,
right, but the question I would ask you before we move on that is that that may be true of us now, and I certainly agree with you, and certainly I believe that you and probably live our lives like that now. But can you remember a time in your journey in following Yehovah that maybe there was a different type of fear and dread that befell you?
Yes.
With the blessings that you had. And so that's what I'm saying. I'm just trying to bring another perspective here.
Sure.
I'm not saying that's what it means. I'm just saying that, you know, in discussing a book like this, we have to look at all the different perspectives and all the different possibilities, and then kind of see if we can tie the whole thing together as we get further and further into the context.
Amen. Now, speaking of fear and dread, and particularly speaking of a time in my walk. Now, you and I, we happen to share some similarity in the traditions from where we've come from. Let's not go into detail in as far as our history is concerned there, but there was a time in my walk in the Sunday church where the fear and dread was well and truly alive, and it wasn't so much the fear and dread of the sovereignty of God or even just the fear of Yehovah. It was the fear and dread of Satan and his demons and so on and so forth. And there needs to be some clarification. The character that we're about to read about, I think we need to define, because there's a lot of, let's say, misidentity. Is that a word I can use?
Yeah.
I believe.
I think I was more afraid of my rabbi growing up than I was of God.
This is what it says. Now, there was a day, Ira, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before Yehovah, and Satan also came among them. And Yehovah said to Satan, "From where do you come from?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Oh, from going back and forth on the earth and from walking back and forth on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant?" Refers to him as my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil, is the description again. And verse 9, so Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hand, of the possessions, and increased the in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. And Jehovah said to Satan, behold, all he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Right. Now, what
right,
I have...
that far?
What I have, we've got to go back. Let's go back to the first verse.
We've got to go back to verse 6.
Verse 6. Got to go back to verse 6. Now, I've got Satan, of course. You know what? I don't even have, first of all, I do have Satan with a capital S as a person, okay? A particular personality and individual. I even have in my New King James Study Bible, I have a subheading that helps me to think the way they want me to think. And it says, Satan attacks Job's character. This is the subheading of this section. Mm-hmm. So we're told already what is, or we're being directed already by this particular translation, the direction of this conversation. Now, there was a day when the sons of God, first question, the sons of God.
Okay, so here we have it. And to me, that's really, I don't want to say more significant, but just as significant when we read B'nai HaElohim in mm-hmm. this verse as we read HaSatan. And I look, there are again going to be very different commentaries and very different interpretations on this. I hold obviously to one that's going to be different than typically what most Christians would hold to, and probably even different than probably most Messianics would hold to as it relates to the B'nai HaElohim. Because what ends up happening is we see that in Bereishit in Genesis chapter 6, related to these B'nai HaElohim, these sons of Elohim, sons of God that appear, you know, and take wives. And, you know, it's this whole idea of the these fallen malachim, these fallen angels.
We get that from Genesis chapter 6, right?
Yeah, in Genesis chapter 6. And so this is where most people make this determination. And so that when they look at this this verse in Job, they make this connection and obviously think that these are divine beings that are appearing before the throne of God. And Satan comes as well. But here's what's very interesting. There's a very interesting concept about this in Rabbinic Judaism that actually speaks of this as being during the time of Rosh Hashanah, or what mm-hmm. we call Yom Teruah, and that this is actually a heavenly court being opened up, and this is why B'nai HaElohim, the sons of God, are appearing before God. And that this could either be human beings, because all human beings stand before the judgment of God mm-hmm. on Rosh Hashanah, but it could also be malachim. It could be the messengers of God or the angels of God, but coming on behalf of their earthly counterparts. And this is why it separates out in the Hebrew that they come, and then it says, and gam hasatam betocham. And also, you know, Hasatam comes with them or comes in their midst. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what we have to understand about Judaism is that Judaism practices what we call rational theology, you know, and that's not meant to be a hit on anybody, but it does practice rational theology. And it rejects this idea of rebellion or fallen angels, because evil is really considered an abstract concept in Judaism. And so when we see this this idea of sons of God in Genesis 6 who married the daughters of men, in Judaism, it's just seen as human beings who had kind of an exalted station, kind of the same way that we could look at somebody like Job. They could have been considered as pagan royalty or members of nobility who just out of lust, you know, married women from a lowly state, from the general population, rather than marrying within nobility. Mm-hmm. We have other interpretations that kind of define these sons of God as maybe tyrannical Near Eastern kings, which also, you know, is interesting as it relates to, you know, Job being, you know, one of the greatest men from the East, who were kind of seen as divine rulers. Remember, we even see that in the monarchy, in modern monarchies, where, you know, people are considered divine. Mm-hmm. And that they're engaging in polygamous behavior. And then what I think is really interesting is that one of the sages brings forth this idea that I think it was Ibn Ezra. It might have been him or one of the other sages. They promoted this idea that because we're talking about Genesis chapter 6, that we're talking about generations that weren't that far removed from Adam and Chava, from Adam and Eve. And so because Adam and Eve kind of had this physical perfection in the fact that they were able to walk with God in the cool of the day in Gan Eden, that it wasn't that far removed. And so they were close enough in generations that they would have been considered physically more perfect than later generations. So these generations that were closer to Adam and Chava, you know, could be seen as this people that were physically better, and so they produced this this race that was that had a greater physical perfection, and this is why they're called
Sons of Elohim.
Sons of Elohim. And then finally, some people just view it as an allegory, primarily for, you know, to discuss the idea of the sin of lust that declined man from his higher nature. And then what do we see? Then we see at the end of this, who shows up with the Sons of Elohim? But,
well, like I said, I've got a capital S Satan. But you know what? This is what my and regular listeners will be aware. My New King James Study Bible, it has a little asterisk from now and then. When it, you know, if it's telling you something that's kind of maybe half true, or if it's telling you something that needs further clarification, it'll just put a little asterisk next to a word. And you have to go and find the tiny, tiny, tiny little writing somewhere else on the page to see what it actually means. Now, it so happens, Ira, that I have an asterisk next to Satan. So I search with my magnifying glass, with my microscope, no less, to find the tiny little writing. And I find it. And this is what it says. It says, literally. Now, don't you love it when it says literally? And you think, well, if this is what it means literally, why don't you put it in the text? But anyway, literally, the adversary. And so throughout the book, it says.
So why put it in the text? You can't put it in the text if you have, preconceived notion, or if you're trying to portray something based on an agenda or based on the writer, you know, is trying to get across. Of course,
you
know, when we look at the Hebrew,
trying to steer you into. Yeah,
sure. When we look at the Hebrew, of course, we know that it's something completely different. And I don't know how deeply we want to go into this, because of course I know that there's a great teaching that Yoel did with you on this subject.
He did go into detail. We did touch on the Book of Job, and it was called Hell, Hades, and Hasatan. People can find that if you put that in the search engine or click on Yoel on the guest page, recent guests, Hell, Hades, and Hasatan. And we did touch on it, but we touched on the Book of Job briefly. We can go into some detail if you like.
Right. And then the other thing is that, of course, I'm assuming, and we should touch on that as well, is that when you do the Torah Pearls with Nehemiah Gordon and Keith Johnson, that I'm sure in Balak, you must have touched on this as well.
You're absolutely correct. Yeah, that's right. Numbers 22, if I remember correctly. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, exactly. And so here we have this. Here we have this character that's introduced. And of course, you know, as you said, you know, unfortunately, we see all the time that we see this individual listed with a capital S, as if it's an individual named Satan. And instead, what we see is this Hasatan, or the Satan, or what we know to be the adversary. And then the question is, who is this adversary? And the interesting thing is that the most recent thing that we should talk about is Bilam, because we just those who follow the weekly Torah portion have just got through reading Bilam about Bilam in the Torah portion Balak, and we have this concept of Lesatan. It doesn't say Hasatan, but it says Lesatan, and it's this adversary that stands against Bilam when he's beating his donkey.
Mm-hmm.
And what it calls this, what we see, this Lisatan is called Malach Yehovah.
And this is Numbers chapter 22, verse 22. It says, then God's anger was aroused because he went, he being Balaam, and the angel, the messenger of Yehovah, took his stand in the way as Hasatan against him.
Right. And so we have here we have this description of a Malach Yehovah, a messenger of God, being called Satan, mm-hmm. being called the adversary. He's not being called Satan, the horned guy with the pitchfork and the red cape that so many people glorify. And I hate to say it that way, but they glorify him.
That's so true.
But this is a Malach Yehovah. What makes this even more powerful in the story of Bilam is that later on in the verses, this Malach Yehovah that stood as Satan, as the adversary, then says to Bilam, yes, go ahead, but you'll only say what I tell you to say. And mm-hmm. so I'm sure that you guys dealt with this as well, and this idea of the role and authority that a Malach Yehovah who stands in the authority of Yehovah is standing there as if Yehovah is speaking himself.
Amen.
And here is this Malach Yehovah who's called Satan who is now telling Bilam that he's only to say what he's supposed to say. Are we then to believe based on this that Satan is the one that's telling Bilam?
It's not an isolated example, Ira. It's not an isolated example. If we go to, let's say, 1 Chronicles chapter 21, verse 1, and it's talking about when David numbered the people, David numbered Israel. 1 Chronicles 21, 1, it says, now Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. And it is said by some, particularly in Christian circles, that here is one of the first cases where even though in Job, for example, we have we capitalize Satan and we refer to him as a particular personality, really we know that it's just the adversary and it's a title and not a name. But we're going to treat it as a name anyway. But really, when you get down to it, we don't really find it Satan as a personality, as a name of a person, until we get to 1 Chronicles 21, verse 1, is what some of them say, some Christian theologians would say. However, when you go to 2 Samuel, we go to 2 Samuel chapter 24, verse 1, it says this, it says, again, the anger of Yehovah was aroused against Israel, and he, Yehovah, it says the anger of Yehovah was aroused against Israel, and he moved David against them to say, go number Israel and Judah. And so here's another example where the adversary is acting on behalf of Yehovah because he's acting in the authority of Yehovah, and it is as if, and it really is as if Yehovah is giving a command to arouse David to number the people. Is that another fair example, do you think?
That is a very fair example. And I think what people need to take away from this is that what's so important about studying the scriptures is to study the scriptures in context and not to come with presumptions or preconceived notions and not to base what you understand on what other people tell you. Because really the truth of the matter is that when we study this concept of the Satan, of the adversary, every one of the scriptures that's brought by Christianity to support this notion of a person with this name, Satan, who stands as the archenemy of God, is unsupported or documented in Scripture.
Totally
they're always going to bring scriptures that allude to the possibility, the anointed cherub, and from Ezekiel and Ezekiel 28, and other scriptures like that, where it doesn't talk about some fallen angel that now has become the archenemy of God. And every time that we see this concept of Satan, an adversary, it's a messenger of God that's working on behalf of God. And we have to understand that God allows these things to happen, that there is this testing that takes place, and that all things, both good and evil, that take place in the world are in control of one entity and one entity alone, and that's Yehovah.
Amen. Amen. And so because he is the implement by which Yehovah, he gives him the commandments, he goes and does what he's told. As we pointed out when I was speaking with Yoel in regards to this topic, the adversary, Hasatan, is, in fact, a righteous servant of Yehovah. In every example that we have in the Tanakh, we have to come to that conclusion. Would you say that that's fair?
Well, I mean, that's certainly the position that's supported by Rabbinic Judaism. He has no grounds for anything he does without the okay of Yehovah. And I think that we see this in verse 7 that you read, because when it goes forward and it says, you know, Vayomer Yehovah el ha-Satan, where God is speaking to Satan, and he says, you know, from where do you come?
Mm-hmm.
And then the Satan, the adversary, answers him. He says, from roaming about on the earth and walking around on it. The question we have to ask is, why would Yehovah, who's the king of the universe, you know, Rabbono Shel Olam, the master of the universe, ask such a question?
As if he doesn't know?
Right, as if he doesn't know. And so I like to use more of a modern, this would be the Ira Michelson version, the IMV version of the Bible, because I think what he's saying, and if we look back at the perspective I brought, that this is some type of divine court, and there is actually some really legal language in this poetic book of Job. So if we look at it from that context, it's more of Yehovah saying to him, where are you coming from? In other words, what perspective are you coming from? So that it wasn't as much a question about geography, but an allowance by Yehovah for the proceedings of the divine court to begin.
We see that, don't we? We have other examples of that where he involves his. It's not as if they're advisors. Yeah, sorry, it is. First Kings chapter 22 with Micaiah, and you know, he's asked to prophesy, and he sees, oh, here we go, verse 19. Therefore, hear the word of Yehovah. I saw Yehovah sitting on his throne, and all the hosts of heaven standing by on his right hand and on his left. And Yehovah said, who will persuade Ahab to go up that he may fall at Ramoth Gilead? And so one spoke in this manner, and another spoke in that manner. Then a spirit came forward and stood before Yehovah and said, I will persuade him. And Yehovah said to him, in what way? And so he said, oh, I'll go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all these prophets. And Yehovah said, you shall persuade him, you shall prevail, go and do so, therefore, lying spirits, so on and so forth. So, but there's an example of where Yehovah says, how shall we do this? What do you reckon? You guys got any ideas? Come on, let's talk about it.
Right. And so we see once again an issue of this divine court standing there and him asking for information. So I think, you know, to bring it back is that this idea that, again, that when he's questioning HaSatan, that it's more about this opening up the divine court for everybody to hear, because we're just about to hear Yehovah in verse 8 say, and we read it, Vayomer Yehovah el HaSatan, Hasamta Livcha Alavdi Iov, Ki Ein Kamohu Ba'eretz Ishtam. We see that Ishtam again, where he's called the blameless man, V'yashal Yere Elohim Basar Meira. The same example that we see at the beginning of the book, we see again, and this is now Yehovah speaking, and he says, have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one. Have you considered his heart, you know, the heart of my servant? You know, there's no one like him on the earth. He's blameless, an upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil.
And there's an addition to the original description of him. The original description is blameless and upright, fears God, shuns evil. But here there is the addition of there is none like him on the earth. I mean, in verse 3, it says he's the greatest of all the people in the east. But all of a sudden here, there's none like him in all the earth.
Right.
So why would you
like?
He
how would you like God to say that about you?
Oh man, I tell you what. But why wouldn't he consider? I mean, obviously, it's not unusual that he may be brought up in conversation, and he says to the adversary, he says to HaSatan, "Hey, check out Job. He's the leading man at the moment. What do you reckon?"
Yeah, and the point is that this goes back to this idea again of the divine court, because you know that by Satan saying that he was going around, walking around, roaming around, that this is his job. This is his job to know this, so that this is why I believe Yehovah was giving him the floor, so to speak.
Sure.
You know, by presenting this and saying, where did you come from? Of course, he came from, he knows. Of course, he's considered him, and this is why he has a ready answer for Jehovah.
He does, yeah. And the ready answer goes from verse 9. Now, what I am really interested in, Ira, I would like to hear from you your perspective on the tone of what Hasatan answers to Jehovah. How do you understand the tone in as far as it reads in the Hebrew?
Where he says, does Job fear God for nothing?
Mm.
Well, I mean, it goes back to, I think, what we were speaking of towards the beginning when I brought up the question of what was the fear? And I think this is the question that I brought up is the same question that Satan, the adversary, is bringing up now.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, because we read in chapter 3, verse 25, that Job himself says, look, the thing that I feared most has come upon me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing that I dread has befallen me. And so here is Hasatan bringing the same argument. He's saying, okay, does Job fear God for nothing? And that's why I asked you the question about at other times in your journey, did you have the same fear of God that you have now?
Mm.
I know that growing up, I don't know about you, but growing up in Orthodox Judaism, we weren't presented now with this idea of Jehovah, this loving father that we have. Even in that, the same way, you know, the rabbi to me presented that, that God that I should fear and have mm-hmm. a reverence. There was a great reverence and awe for him. But of course, I feared losing the things that I had, you know, the blessings that I had from God mm-hmm. if I didn't do the right thing. And so I think this is the tone that Satan is bringing now as the adversary, saying, okay, that's great. You know, we're talking about a guy who has sons and daughters. He has camels. He has donkeys. He has this great wealth. He's considered one of the greatest men of the East. But what's the reason that he really fears you? And
you think he's saying, you know, he has so much that it's constantly on his mind to tread carefully as to not bring about his own downfall, as to not sin and bring about his own downfall and incur curses as opposed to blessings for his obedience and faithfulness.
Exactly. And that could be mm-hmm. one of the perspectives that's brought, that he walked in this constant fear,
mm-hmm.
which is why I brought this up, which is the tone that I think that the Satan, the adversary, is bringing. Because in the next verse we read, he says, come on, you made a fence around him and his house
mm.
and everything around him, you know, everything around him. You've blessed the work of his hands and his possessions have increased. Actually, it says, U-miknehu paratz ba'aretz. It's talking about his cattle breaking forth in the land.
Wow.
Literally is what that's saying, that you're breaking forth. And that concept of breaking forth is, I'm sure you have animals.
Mm.
And it's this idea of his animals, he was getting even greater wealth because his animals were bringing forth offspring. You know, he's saying to him, you know, of course a guy is fears you, Jehovah. You've made a fence around him. You've placed a hedge around him and around everything, misaviv, everything around him.
Mm.
You know, all ma'asei yadav berachta, you've blessed all that he does with his hands.
Mm. Now, but is the tone, though, now in the tradition that I've come from, Ira, the tone of that answer to God is mm-hmm. kind of cynical. It's kind of a challenge. It's kind of waving the red flag in his face and saying, come on, you know, hey, you want to put this to the test? Because really, I mean, you can't use him as an example because, I mean, you know, look what you've given him. I mean, you've set this guy up so that he's a goody-goody. Come on. You know, let's play the game here a little bit. Do you think it's kind of like that, or do you think it's just a matter of stating the facts?
Some people would actually say that the Satan, the adversary, is even challenging God in this. You know, I don't know that I would go so far in that, but I think if we go back to the idea that one of the things that we have to remember is because we have not determined whether or not, and I don't think we can determine who wrote it, when it was written, what it was about, whether it was mashal, you know, a parabolic, you know, the truth of the matter is that we know that the entire book is meant to teach us about human suffering and the interaction of human suffering
mm-hmm.
As it relates to what we have and what we don't have. And when we go through trials and things like that, that we have to have this we have to have this questioning that takes place. And I think the questioning that's brought forth here by Satan in this discussion with God brings us forward to a context later in the book. Mm-hmm. We get into the real theme of it, which is this idea of questioning God.
So yeah, that's right. The questioning of God and the sovereignty of God. I'm inclined to say, and it's just my opinion, that the response by HaSatan to Yehovah is part of the created character of HaSatan, and therefore God is not taken aback by that. He's not thinking, I'm going to smite you, sunshine, because you're getting a bit too smart. He's thinking, okay, this is what I expect from you. This is the way that I've created you, and this is what you're thinking. So let's have a look at this. And so Yehovah said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person. So Satan went out from the presence of Yehovah. Now, Ira, here it goes. This is what happens. Now, there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys were feeding beside them when the Sabaeans raided them and took them away.
We have to stop for a second. We have to go back.
Who are the Sabaeans?
We have to go back for a second.
Sure.
I'm doing an NG on you here. Okay. We have to go back. because there's something something that I want to point out in verse 11. Because in verse 11, where Satan now says, after he says, of course, you've put a fence around him, it says, "Ve'ulam shalachna yadcha vega bechol asher lo imlo al panecha yivarachecha." Okay, I'm saying it differently because I'm so used to saying yivarachecha. Okay, which we know is part of the Aaronic blessing, which we're all getting ready to read this incredible book that's written about that.
Shattering the Conspiracy of Silence.
Shattering the Conspiracy of Silence.
If you haven't got it already, oh my goodness, if you haven't got it already, listeners, you need to get a hold of it before he runs out and has to print more. You can get it from nehemiahswall.com, nehemiahswall.com. There is a link on the right-hand side sidebar on truth2you.org.
Right, so the question is, we're looking at this and we're saying, he says, but if you remove your hand from him and all that he has, okay, im lo al panecha yivarachacha, okay, that he will bless your face, that doesn't make any sense.
No, we see that in verse 5 as well, don't we? It may be that my sons have sinned and blessed God in their hearts, but that doesn't make any sense.
Right, it doesn't make sense. So I just wanted to go back to that and just kind of explain this situation to your readers if somebody sees this and they're wondering what this is about, because it's actually spelled a little differently. When we say Yivarechecha, because in the Aaronic blessing, Yivarechecha Yehovah ben Evelecha, we say, may Jehovah bless you and keep you. We say that Yivarechecha, may he bless you. Okay? So why would Satan say that if you remove your hand from him, that he'll bless your face? No, it says cursing in English. Why does it say that? Because this is actually what we call a kari kativ in the Hebrew. And what it is it's a situation where they use a euphemism instead of using the actual word, because the actual word may be too offensive. And because the scribes don't want to write in a Torah the word for cursing the face of God, they instead use yivarachecha. Okay, so it's spelled a little bit differently. In other words, instead of having the segol under the resh, which would be yivarachecha, it's spelled with a chatav patach under the resh instead of the segol. And it's kind of like we see in the idea of the alofim and Tehorim, which is a caricative related to the hemorrhoids. They didn't want to use hemorrhoids, so we have, you know what I'm talking about.
And the golden hemorrhoids.
So we see, and that's a caricative in the Torah as well, which is, where they, and for those that don't understand what caricative is, kari meaning what's said and kativ what's written. Mm-hmm. And so what they did was, so that when we read it in the synagogue, if we see, if we see one word, we're supposed to read what they wrote in there, and then you might see you don't see it in a Torah scroll, but in other places in the manuscripts, you might see a Masorah or a brackets or something like that that tells you that this is the way it's written, but this is the way it should be read. So I just thought that was important for people to know.
Excellent. I'm glad that you brought that up. And I'm glad we went back to verse 11, because it's worth pointing out to the connection between 11 and 12, and that is that Hasatan says, but now stretch out your hand. He says, stretch out your hand, Yehovah. Stretch out your hand and touch all that he has. And in verse 12, Yehovah says, okay, fine. All that he has is in your power. Therefore, Hasatan is acting as your hand, acting as the hand of Yehovah to achieve his will. Fair?
Right, right. Okay. And then he actually says, you know, later in the verse, in the second part of the verse, of verse 12, it says, "Rak elav al tishlach yadecha," only upon him you shall not send your hand.
So he gives him specific instructions, and he can't go beyond that. He has to be obedient.
Exactly. He has to be obedient to that.
Mm. And we read later, and we'll get to this eventually. Let's not delve into this right now. But in chapter 2, verse 3, Yehovah says, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. We'll talk about that in just a little moment. Well, you know what? That's probably going to be next week. Let's see if
probably
we can finish chapter 1.
Yeah. I don't know that we're going to get finished with chapter 1, but okay. Yeah, we'll try to.
And so the Sabaeans, who are the Sabaeans?
That's
the
a good Sabaeans question. Who do you them? Think they are?
I don't know. Well, I've got a little asterisk here, and the asterisk just says literally Sheba.
Right. So that's what it says in actually in the Hebrew, it says Shva, Vatipol Shva. And so it's normally translated as Sheba.
Okay. As in the queen of Sheba who visited
maybe.
Shlomo.
Perhaps. Maybe. And then we have the Solomon connection there. That would be really interesting, right?
Yeah, right. Interesting. Well, they raided them. They took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, now it all happens at once, which is really harsh. Another came and said, now this is interesting. Fire, the fire of God, the fire of Elohim fell from heaven. Mm-hmm. You know what I think of when I read that? I think of up on Mount Carmel, where we've got the prophets of Baal trying to cause fire to fall from heaven, praying to a false god. And we have Elijah, who of course achieves the desired end by the power of Yehovah. And here we have, once again, just to emphasize that it is Hasatan acting on behalf of Yehovah with the authority of Yehovah. He's in charge. He's doing it. He is the one in the authority of Yehovah who causes fire, the fire of God, to fall from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, the Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels and took them away, yes, and killed the servants, all the servants, with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking. Boy, they eat and drink a lot of wine, these guys.
Yeah,
In the older brother's house. And suddenly, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And it all hits Job all at once, with seemingly within the space of a couple of minutes. And then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell on the ground, and worshipped.
And worshipped. So when we look at verses 14 through 19, we have some interesting things. So Rambam, you know, Moshe Maimonides describes three different types of destruction related to this. He talks about natural disasters that include freak violent eruptions of natural forces. He speaks about harm inflicted by human beings upon each other, meaning, you know, that you would think of like negligence and crime and war, and then harm that we inflict upon ourselves through unhealthy and bad lifestyle, like lust and folly and vice and things like that. Mm-hmm. And what they say is that the Satan, the adversary, brings the first two forms of harm upon Job. Natural disasters and harm inflicted by human beings. Because we see the Shva, the Shiva, and Kastim, the translated Chaldeans, were motivated by greed and a desire for power, of course, right? Mm-hmm. And so Job is the victim of their wickedness. And so first we see the fire and the wind belonging to the first category, a natural disaster, fire falling from heaven. Certainly an unusual occurrence, as you mentioned. But of course, fire is also a natural phenomenon, so we don't know what it was. I mean, look, we saw, you know, hail that came down a Mitzrayim mm-hmm. you know, that was mixed with fire and caused fire. Right? So, but all of these, the interesting thing is that all of these calamities, as you talked about, occurred in really a very rapid kind of progression. And he has no rest from this, no opportunity to kind of collect himself. And before he's informed of the next strategy, it's one after the other.
Mm.
Everything
he has, like Yehovah says, you know, behold, all that he has is in your power. All that he has is in your power. And now all that he has is gone in the space of a couple of minutes, as far as he's aware. Sure. What are the first words out of his mouth?
Oh, in verse 21, Vayomer Arom Yatzati mi beten imi va'arom ashuv shema Yehovah natan ve'Yehovah lakach yihi shem Yehovah mevarach. I love that. Yihi shem Yehovah mevarach. He said, naked I came from the womb of my mother, and naked I will return. Yehovah gave, and Yehovah takes away. Blessed be the name of Yehovah.
Now, there's an obvious question there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't Yehovah the name of Yehovah? Isn't it revealed in Exodus to the children of Israel in Sinai? Here we are, and Job, potentially the oldest book of the Bible, and he says, blessed be the name of Yehovah.
Absolutely. Very interesting, right?
Very interesting.
That he knew the name of Yehovah. So and this would make sense if he was, of course, he said earlier, as we read, that have you considered my servant Job? Mm. Being considered and being called God's servant, it would be not surprising that God would reveal his name. But I just want to share with the people personally, because I understand this, and all of us have gone through these kind of things. And so I want people, since this is the beginning of our program, to understand that this is a book that really speaks to how to deal with suffering and mm-hmm. how to deal with the sovereignty of God, and recognizing that there is nothing that is allowed to come upon you that's not been allowed by Yehovah, that there mm-hmm. isn't this adversary that's coming against you for your bad. You know, Laurie and I, years ago, and I think I might have told you part of this story, Jonah, but years ago, Lori and I had this incredible experience. And the reason why I bring this up is because that here is this intense pain of personal tragedy that's usually delayed due to the impact of the initial shock. But he doesn't get this. It's one thing after another, four tragedies. And I've lived through this myself, you know. And I remember what it was like for Lori and I going through. We had this incredible time on a mountain one time where we had this experience with Yehovah. And then we came down from the mountain, and it was one thing after another. It was I got sick and ended up in the hospital. Lori ended up having some numbness in her arm, and they sent her for all kinds of tests and diagnosed her with MS, which it turned out not to be, even though she was diagnosed with it. As a result of that, she had some crazy tests, and we didn't know she was pregnant at the time, and she lost the baby. Mm. And so we went through these tragedies one after the other, and it seemed like there was no let up. We didn't have this opportunity to get over one thing before we got over the next thing. And when we really sat down, it really spoke to us. And this is why I thought it was important to do this, and why I agreed to do the Book of Job with you, because it really became real in my life, and it really changed my perspective on the relationship that I have with Yehovah and this concept of Satan, this adversary. Because when everything was said and done, with all the pain, with all the anguish, with everything that we went through, because we look at things from a Hebraic perspective and not the way our Christian brothers and sisters do, looking at it from a very Hebraic perspective, we learned about the sovereignty of God. And really, we came out stronger out the other end than we did when we came in.
My goodness. Well, first of all, let me say thank you for sharing part of your personal life, because I know that when it comes to examples that are parallel to the Book of Job, it's very difficult, but I appreciate that. And it is an amazing thing that Job also recognized what you had just been expressing. He recognized that the first thing that he did was he fell to the ground and he worshipped God. He said these words, and in verse 22 it says, in all this Job did not sin nor charge God with any wrong.
Amen. Unfortunately, I was not the same as Job.
I was just about to say,
and that's why I said I learned through that experience. And I would hope that I can now say that. And too, look, I just went through this. You know, this will be played at another time, but I just lost my father recently, you know, and I'm going through that situation now. This is one of the things that we talk about in death in Judaism, is this idea of the Lord gives and the Lord takes away, you know, Yehi Shem Yehovah Mevarach. Blessed be the name of the Lord.
Blessed be the name of Yehovah. Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. Because in verse 22, when I read it, every time I read it, in all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong, I feel guilty.
Well, not yet, at least.
So
we're in the first chapter. He doesn't. That's why I say not yet, because whenever I read that, I know it says that through all this, Job did not sin nor blame God. You know, but at some point he does kind of end up kind of being a little bit self-righteous at some point.
He does have a dummy spit later on. We're going to get to that. And, so we're going to do chapter 2 next week. Are we going to do next week?
At your pleasure.
And our Satan appears again, and off we go again. And we're going to see how he deals with that. Ira Michelson, Torah teacher Ira Michelson from Florida, my friend, thank you for being the very first time on Truth to You. I have to say, I've really enjoyed discussing the first chapter of Job with you, my friend. I can't wait until we get to chapter 2.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm excited. You know, I'm excited about going forward and seeing where this takes us.
It's a blessing to have you. And until next time, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.